IsraelSin.com. Erev Tov. Good evening. I will spend just a very brief few minutes putting us sort of a little, just the tiniest of recaps to put us back in the mind frame of where we were when we left off. We spoke about the first commandment. The first commandment, I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt from the house of slaves. We went into detail about, we sort of divided the commandment into two parts. I am the Lord your God. Talked about the meaning of what it means to have a God and having a God not just being something that we turn to outside of us, but in a certain sense a kind of ideal that we adopt for ourselves. If you worship the sun, you unconsciously or consciously want to be like the sun. If you worship the muscle tissue of the gods, then unconsciously or consciously you want to be very, very strong. We took that. We then took a look at the second half where we talked about the exodus from Egypt as being the single defining thing that at this particular moment, this God who wants to introduce himself chooses to use. And together we discover what we call the spirit of redemption, the idea that the first commandment represents, an idea that every single one of us has both the ability and the obligation to intervene in our world, in human history. Okay, to make it better, of course. And we stuck redemption into this little space in our chart, which over the course of this week and the next few weeks, we will be filling in order to explain the whole broad arc of all the 10 major ideas that the 10 commandments represent. One thing I didn't quote for you last week, but just to get a sense of the fact that I'm not making all of this up, Maimonides, you remember Maimonides, Maimonides from the 11th century, whose greatest hits include The Guide to the Perplexed, the most influential philosophical work in Jewish history, the Mishneh Torah, the most influential legal work in Jewish history, and a few excellent B-side hits. When Maimonides decided that he wanted to tell us what prophecy is really all about, based on his analysis of the biblical scriptures, of the texts, and reading all the prophets and trying to understand what they were really all about, he understood that there were really 10 levels, or 12 levels, of prophetic inspiration, the first level of which is as follows. Oh, in the book, it's on page 38. Bottom of page 38. The first degree of prophecy, it's also up on the wall. The first degree of prophecy consists in the divine assistance which is given to a person and induces and encourages him to do something good and grand. For example, to deliver a congregation of good men from the hands of evildoers, to save one noble person, or to bring happiness to a large number of people. He finds in himself the cause that moves and urges him to his deed. This degree of divine influence is called the Spirit of the Lord. All the judges of Israel possessed this degree. This faculty was always possessed by Moses from the time he had attained the age of manhood. It moved him to slay the Egyptian and to prevent evil from the two men that quarreled. It was so strong that after he had fled from Egypt out of fear and arrived in Midian, a trembling stranger, he could not restrain himself from interfering when he saw wrong being done. He could not bear it. Okay, so here we see, not only have we captured what I called the spirit of redemption, what Maimonides labels based on the usage in the Bible itself as the spirit of the Lord, he sees it not simply as being the striking characteristic of Moses, but also as being the first stage, the first step towards prophecy, towards being, whatever a prophet is. The later stages being some kind of communication with the divine, whether in dreams or while awake, whether through commands or through storytelling, or all these different kinds of variations of it. The very first step towards it is this, this spirit that makes you want to make the world better. What does that tell us about prophecy? What does that tell us about what prophecy ultimately is? And this is a side point. You know, it's not about the Ten Commandments per se, but it's a very striking statement to say that that's what prophecy begins with. It begins with wanting to change the world.
Tikkun Olam.
Tikkun Olam, want to flesh that out?
I don't know. Righting the wrongs of the world?
Okay, so prophecy is about righting the wrongs of the world.
Or making the people aware of what's in the wrong path they're going in.
Making people aware of what they're doing wrong and could be doing better.
Yeah.
Acting in the image of God.
Okay, but that's sort of that only helps if you know what God looks like.
Yeah.
Okay, we're trying to figure that out.
You're personally compelled to act. There's something inside you that has no choice but to, in a sense, there's a choice obviously, but that you're compelled to do what you perceive or experience as being correct or right.
Correct or right? Is that what it is? Because correct or right could just be sitting and building something with LA.
But it's a deep... Okay, so it's... Let me go... It's obvious to you that it is the truth. It's obvious to you... And
truth could be mathematics.
It can be.
Is that true for the prophets?
Making the world a better place.
Making the world a better place. That's the key difference. Okay? That's what distinguishes...
And what makes the world a better place?
That's a good question. Okay, in every case, that's a good question. But it's clearly, what I'm saying is, it's a moral rather than simply a love of the theoretical. It's not simply what you might... Let's say that you happen to be sitting, instead of in a Beit Midrash, you're sitting in a cave with Plato. I know, he didn't sit in a cave, but we talked about caves. Okay, Plato believed that the ultimate philosophical endeavor had to do with cognition, with understanding the forms of the universe. It wasn't fundamentally a moral, making the world better kind of impetus, right? It was theoretical. It was the pleasure of merging, you know, with the theoretical realms. Okay, that's what Greece is very much, at least the philosophical side of Greece, is very much about. Okay, there's this other world, inhabited by gods, or later by logic and reason and theories, and your job in life is to somehow connect with that. What Maimonides is saying here is the prophets might look like that at first, but if you look at them in the Bible, every single one, every single time they had anything to say that was worth recording, it was always about making the world a better place. Okay?
But their manifestation was more in the sense of bringing attention to the people of what derech they're headed towards and the danger if they continue on that derech. But that's different than actually doing action in the world to make it a better place.
That's why we had, in addition to prophets, we also had kings and judges. And the Bible is very much a tension, right? There's a huge tension between the life of the prophet, which is really, you know, today we might talk about poets and filmmakers and authors, but the life of the person who says, here's a critique of our world, make it better, and the life of the political leader, or let's say the political leader, because that's sort of the extreme case, where his whole life's work is to influence the world. You look skeptical when I talk about political leaders in such in such light, favorable light.
But better is very subjective.
But what is it suggesting?
Better, yeah. I mean, there is no clear definition. So one definition would be that if you follow all the mitzvot, that means that it's better.
Right.
But besides that, I can't see, because you and I, or whatever, we would have different opinions about what is a Republican to a Democrat, with tax, no tax, everything. So it's better place.
We'll talk about it. We will get there. Okay, we won't answer it, but we'll get there. What I want, today we're going to talk about the second commandment. Okay? Having established redemption not just as the point of the first commandment, but as something we need to, we're going to want to refer back to throughout our entire conversation. We're now ready to move on to the second commandment, which last week I asserted has something to do with morality. Okay? Morality, the assertion that there's such a thing as better. Okay, I'm going to take the most basic definition of morality. The most basic definition of morality is that there is something that's better than other things. Even if we disagree about it, it's not the same. Even if we allow a certain amount of tolerance for differing views, it's not the same as saying there is no better. That the world is simply what it is. As people say, it is what it is. Okay, the Bible, across the board from beginning to end, asserts that there's such a thing as better for this world. And again, Democrats, Republicans, what they have in common is that they insist on affiliating with some kind of a vision for making the world better and acting towards that, as opposed to other people who don't vote, don't care, live their lives. Okay. I'm sorry, I should stop that. One more second. All right. Now, here's the text of the second commandment. It's long, so what you want to read it since you have it in front of you? With gusto? Read it like you're on the mountain and this is your one chance to read it right.
You mean dramatically or without mistakes?
You're on your way up anyway.
You shall have no other gods beside me. You shall not make for yourself a carved idol or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth below. Is this dramatic enough?
Great.
Or that is in the water below, under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generations of those that hate me, but showing mercy to thousands of generations of those that love me and keep my commandments.
Tough. Long, tough, powerful, a little nasty, but pretty clear in its simple reading, right? We're turning to a world that is full of idols, full of things we worship that are not God, things that we carve images to, we bow down to, we convince ourselves that through some combination of manipulating the small little world around us, we can somehow tap in to whatever it is that makes our crops come up on time and our rains come when they're supposed to and prevents massive flooding and so on and so forth. Somehow, that's the best way that we can survive and live is to have these little idols or big idols, these endless tabernacles to different gods. And this is coming, on a very simple reading, is coming to get rid of all of that. Get rid of it completely and totally. And, you know, and with all of God's, the power of God's threats. What I want to talk about today is why we should care at all about this commandment. Because it seems very clear that we don't really have this problem anymore, right? We don't have statues that we bow down to. We have statues, you know, works of art, and most people don't look at those as really, you know, idolatrous.
Yeah, but
we have lots of.
That's not. I don't think that's what that's about.
So help us out.
I think the ancients were not as stupid as we make them out to be, and the idols that they had, and whatever physical representations they considered as sacred representations, they were representations of a larger idea.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, the caricature is of someone bowing down to an idol. But that idol represented something, just in the same way that we say in Shul, v'anachnu korim u'mishtachavim, of course, to the one God.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's just a caricature to reduce this to a prohibition against, you know, literally physical physical representation. It's really about competing forces. I think this is about the singularity.
Okay.
We talk about physics, the all-encompassing that everyone.
In other words, it's avoiding multiplicity in favor of a single idea of what the world ought to be like, or a single being that represents that ideal. Redemption being this one thing, because if you have multiple goods, then ultimately there is no real good. There's only whatever your good happens to be.
That's what I wanted to say.
Okay. I'm gonna partially agree and partially disagree in just a minute. Yeah?
I think that we worship a lot of things that don't look like idols today. There are plenty of people who are deeply committed to money, to their computers, to having, and allow these things to take over their lives. Yes, their iPhones. If you ever sat with a group of young people, you can't even make eye contact anymore because they're all sitting there, they're completely addicted. And it becomes a worship. It becomes, like if you miss a call, it's the end of the world. It takes over your life.
Eye contact.
Right? Eye contact. Well, I can't read it.
The Jewish woman just...
I'm sorry. It was a spontaneous joke with a bad marker. But this is what you can make.
Eye contact. Oh, sure. Eye contact. Very good. Very good.
There's this Jewish woman who just did a documentary called Connected, and one of the things she said that she had been at a dinner with somebody she really wanted to be with, and she excused herself to go to the bathroom, but really she didn't go to the bathroom. She went to the bathroom in order to check her email. And at that moment she had an aha experience, realizing, I have just, what did I just do in my life? It was more important for me to check my email than to spend...
But let it be said, to her credit, that she was at least embarrassed enough about checking her email in public that she went to the bathroom.
Yeah.
Okay.
She was older a little bit.
All right. Let's just try to move forward a little bit. Before we go into defining what I think the Bible is really after, I just want to make one observation. And that is that throughout the biblical text, you have a recurring connection being made between idolaters and immoral people. Bad people. Okay? People that we would consider bad. Okay? Over and over and over again, we hear stories of kings who the list of their atrocities begins with, you know, the king Manasseh, who, you know, sacrificed his child to the Baal and made, you know, these bamot all over the place and worshiped the trees. And just did all, like the whole litany of really bad, bad idolatrous practices. And then it says, and he filled the streets of of Jerusalem with blood from one end to the other, and was essentially a very murderous leader. You have the very first case of idolatry in the whole Bible. Anybody want to toss out the first case of clear idolatry in the Bible?
Of what?
Of clear idolatry.
Hey,
before that. First person who had idols?
Laban.
Okay, Laban, the father of
Rachel
and Leah, the father-in-law of Jacob, who we know two things about him. We know that he swindled Jacob over and over again, forcing him to work 7 years for Rachel's hand and then switching the brides on the night of the wedding and making him work another 7 years for Rachel's hand. And we know that just before they left, right, when they took off finally having had enough, Rachel steals her father's trafim, his little statuettes, and later on an entire drama ensues and a negotiation takes place about getting them back for him. So we have a connection being made again between somebody who's a swindler and somebody who's an idolater. There's a third example, and this is actually in more of a rabbinic example, but I love this story so much that I have... Did we talk last week about this guy, the story of Micah? There's a prophet named Micah. Okay, Micah. There's another guy named Micah who's not the prophet, and he appears in the book of Judges. Okay, he's a minor figure. He's just some guy. Okay, and it's just at the time when the tribes are just settling in, and all the tribes sort of taking their places, except for one tribe, which is the tribe of Dan, which was supposed to be down in the sort of, you know, Gaza kind of area. That's why the Tel Aviv area is called Gush Dan, except that they didn't settle there because there were all these Philistines there instead, and they lost. So instead they ended up sort of wandering up way up to the north, and that's why there's a place way up north called Tel Dan, which is like, you know, way, way, way up north, because the Danites started down there and then sort of drifted northward. And in the middle of this drift, in the middle of this sort of unstable situation, you have this guy, this schlub named Micah. Okay? And Micah has a mother. Okay? This is in the Bible. Micah's mother says to him, listen, I need you to do something for me. Here's 200 talents or whatever of silver. I want you to make a statue. I want you to make a tabernacle. I want you to buy yourself a Levite. And I want you to do this for me. Okay? So, it's not much of a story, really. The guy does what his mother tells him to do. He's very happy that he's fulfilled his mother's desires. And then this band of marauding Danites comes plowing through, steals his statue, steals his Levite, and go on by themselves. Okay? End of story. Several thousand years later, the rabbis said the following. They said, why was Micah not counted among the wicked? Because he offered his bread to travelers. Okay? This is an astonishing statement. Okay, you have the second commandment, right, being nakedly violated, flagrantly violated in the middle of this story with, you know, gods of silver, gods of gold, the whole thing, right? There is no greater violation, at least of the letter of the law, than what's going on right there. And the rabbis come and say, but he wasn't such a bad guy. He gave bread to passersby. He was a good guy.
He was a good guy. He did it for his mother.
He did it for his mother. Okay? He didn't really believe in that stuff. Now, you can say, okay, you know, funny story, Polish mother, whatever you want to say. But the bottom line is that in many other cultures, in many other, especially you want to call it the rabbis legalistic, here's a great example of where they're not being nearly as legalistic as you might think. Okay? The rabbis are saying this flagrant violation of the law wasn't really, in essence, a violation at all. Because deep down inside, this guy was a good guy. He was nice to people. He took care. He was nice to his mother. What do you want from him? Okay, so here we see a powerful, clear connection being drawn between idolatry and morality. If you're not violating, if you're just doing the motions of idolatry, but have not inherited some kind of essence, some kind of amoral essence, that's the real danger of idolatry, then really you're okay. You haven't really crossed that line.
And who's to judge?
The judge is to judge, usually.
No, but how about all the other bumos that existed at the time, before the Josianic reform, where there were representations and Levim who...
By and large, you have a biblical text that doesn't like them very much. That says, king after king, it says, but he didn't get rid of the bumos, so he's a bad king. Okay, there's clearly an effort in the adjudication of the narrator is saying, this was not good because these bamot were there. Okay, there was a deeply corrupting element there. What I'd like to do...
So this breaks the pattern. In other words, previously you were saying that idolaters are connected with bad people, you know, negative stereotypes. And here's an idolater, you know, he's a phony idolater, right?
So apparently, what it does is it points to something more profound than the practices of idolatry, as pointing to the actual problem. The actual problem with idolatry is something deeper than idolatry itself. Such that if that deeper thing isn't being invoked, then idolatry itself wouldn't be such a terrible thing if it weren't for its deeper moral problems. And I would like to go take the next step and be able to discuss a little bit. The problem is that in order to really understand idolatry, to understand its place in the Bible and its place in rabbinic tradition, you have to talk about one specific case of idolatry. The most famous case of idolatry, the mega mama case of idolatry, is
the golden calf.
Thank you, the golden calf. Okay. Do you know what this picture is from?
Wall Street, yeah.
This is from the Occupy Wall Street protests not too long ago. Okay, greed, false idol, people dressed up as stockbrokers.
But only that is simple.
What?
It was only that simple.
We're only that simple.
What is that?
It is the golden calf. Okay?
Idol of Wall Street.
Okay? So it is being said. The golden calf. The rabbis taught that the golden calf was the ultimate sin. If you look at the text purely from a literary standpoint, its positioning in the text makes it seem like it's the ultimate sin, right? You've got the Ten Commandments being delivered up on the mountain. Moses has them in hand, and he's told, as his first act of bringing it to the people, before he even has a chance to, they've made a golden calf. The rabbis also taught that every single generation has in it an ounce of the golden calf. Okay? So in the rabbis' view, the golden calf was not a one-off deal. It was a paradigmatic story. It was something that teaches us something about ourselves. Okay? Not just about the sin of the time. We know the story. Moses is up on the mountain. He had neglected to present a clear, binding timeline for his return. And the leaders start getting nervous. They come to Aaron, and when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves to Aaron and said to him, "Up, make us a god which shall go before us. As for this man, Moses, who brought us up out of Egypt, we know not what has become of him." And Aaron said to them, "Break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, of your sons and of your daughters, and bring them to me." And all the people broke off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold at their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made a molten calf. And they said, this is your God of Israel that brought you up out of Egypt. Right? In the Hebrew it's plural. These are your gods. But it's a little confusing. This is the story. They make the golden calf. Moses comes down from the mountain. He smashes the tablets. We discussed that later, we'll discuss it again. But what's important to see here, first of all, on the monotheism versus polytheism question, we suddenly have this sort of uncomfortable sense that the example of idolatry is not a polytheistic example, right? How many golden calves are there? There's one golden calf. Okay. Later on, by the way, there were two. There were like these two golden calves. Later on, but for now, one golden calf. Secondly, it's God, isn't it? I mean, it isn't even some other God. It's a representation of God that took them up out of Egypt from the house of slaves. This is your Lord. This is your God of Israel that brought you up out of Egypt. Ela Elohecha Israel Asher Heelucha Meretz Mitzrayim. Right? So if we have a case where there's only one golden calf, and we know that this is the paradigmatic idolatrous act, then we have to look for something other than the question of multiplicity as when we're looking to figure out what's really wrong with idolatry. Yeah?
I have a quick question.
Yes.
Just going back a second. They didn't get the Ten Commandments yet, so they don't know this is not okay, right? So is this really a sin if they didn't know it's not okay yet?
That's a quick question.
Yeah,
quick questions with long answers.
I guess the question is, right? Like they didn't know.
I don't believe that up until that point they've had no inkling as to the nature of the moral code that is associated with God. Okay, they have a tradition going back to Abraham. They have. They have repeated statements by Moses that say, God's back, God's going to take you out. God's going to take you to the desert. Come with us to worship God. I suspect that the laws of, you know, not eating shark may not have yet been known to them. But the laws of not worshiping idols, especially a calf, which in Egypt, I mean, there's this whole backstory with calves in Egypt and how their forefathers were shepherds, and because they were shepherds, they were reviled by the Egyptians who worshiped the calf. The worship of a calf has a resonance. Okay? What does that resonance say? It says, this new thing you're bringing us, this God we can't see or touch, we can't handle it. We need a God that we can handle. And the God that we can handle is a golden calf. It's a statue. That's the gods that we know. It's very simple. It's saying, let's go back to what we're comfortable with.
Can I just clarify here?
Mm-hmm.
To Label's point that these objects are representations of, say, powers or something that have resonance psychologically speaking. So what you suggested was that for the Israelites, taking on the God of the Egyptians, who were the all-powerful, would be their salvation.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it's to be understood. Why they chose a calf instead of, say, a fox.
I believe the choice of the calf is very significant. It's weighty.
And
it suggests their backsliding back to the ways of the world of the Egyptians.
That's quite interesting. Here you have Pharaoh, better or worse, was the king, the big king. Mm-hmm. You had Moses who became it. Moses disappears, and they go back to the calf. They go not to a person, but to the calf, which was represented as the ultimate.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever notice? I don't know. Maybe it's just in the movies, but like there's a certain visual connection between Pharaoh, especially like Yul Brynner Pharaoh, and ram horns, like. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I know probably the Ramses thing is just an English thing, has nothing to do with it. But the St. Louis Rams thing going on with that football helmet, that as Pharaoh, there's a visual resonance of calves or rams or these animals. I understand that the calves and lambs and rams are not the same animal, but they're from a shepherding farming perspective, they're similar. They're very different from, say, a shark.
One
more, and then we'll want to keep going.
What was so important about having a bull or a calf in Egyptian society? I mean, what did that represent for them, for the Egyptians, that it would be so, you know?
It was. I don't know that it was more or less than the other competing gods, but it was certainly one of them, and it was certainly something from what I understand, you know, from our tradition, is that it was one of a key god, and that therefore they didn't believe in it. In shepherding, just like, you know, in certain places in India, you're not going
to...
You know,
so they felt it was a step up to go with a bovine.
Oh, that I don't know. That I don't know. I wouldn't go that far. I'm not going to split hairs that far to say whether it's bovine versus sheep. Let's keep going. What I want to focus on is in this passage here is that I believe that it contains some of the key elements to understanding what it is about this story. What is it we're after? What's troubling us here is not how many there are. What's troubling here is the difference between a golden calf and the God that Moses presented up till now. Okay? They're different. They claim to have the same powers, but there's something so radically different about this golden calf that it's worth, you know, putting the whole story on hold for and smashing the tablets for and doing all the things that we're about to talk about exactly what they did. What is it about the golden calf that makes it so compelling and makes it so different from God? Yeah.
Is it how they act around it? With their behavior, they get wild and crazy and drunk.
I don't know. You ever get...
Like when you have these false idols, the behavior goes down.
Can we go through Bnei Brak and Purim? I don't know.
The physicality, the material.
Okay, there's the okay, but what
visual.
About the visual? What about the visual? What's the golden calf look like? It's beautiful. Okay, it's this beautiful. Look, you're out in the desert there, right? The best thing that they've got is these shmatas that they're carrying around with the sticks and all that stuff, right? And it's this up coming from the desert, this golden. visual, it's a very, very powerful visual thing. It's a thing of beauty. So one thing is beauty. What else do we know about this calf? What else do we know about this calf other than its beauty? Well, we know it's very powerful, right? Okay, we know that it's powerful enough to bring people up out of Egypt. It's powerful as God. Okay? Just bear with me for a minute. I'm creating three categories that I think we're going to discover very, very important. Power, beauty. Well, what's the third thing? What do we see is going on here? The story goes into detail about its creation.
It comes from everybody.
Everybody put it together, and they made it. Right? The works of our hands. Mm-hmm. Now, throughout the Bible, it's going to turn out that these three qualities, the power of the idol, the beauty of the idol, and the fact that it is the work of our own hands, these are the sources of its dramatic pull.
Sounds like the work of our own hands. By that
sounds like
mean.
What? Sounds like what?
Sounds like the iPad to me.
Sounds like that.
No, seriously, I'm not trying to be cynical. It's a thing of beauty, it's powerful, and it was man-made.
What? It's not beautiful.
Don't get insulted. He's got an iPad. You have an actual iPad on the table.
My iPad just spoke to me and said, you're hurting its feelings.
I'm sorry.
Complimenting it.
I want to get back to that in a minute because you're pushing in the right direction, but I just want to develop the story just a few more steps and then we'll get back to it. Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, the point about, and we all made it. I mean, I accept the idea in the text that everyone contributed the material that went into its creation.
Yep.
But when Aaron was confronted by Moses, who said, what did you do here? And he said, well, they couldn't wait. I took the stuff, I threw it into the fire, and the thing came out.
Yeah, do you believe him?
He's like, Michael?
No, but there's no... I mean, this wasn't like the ark that was... the tabernacle that was built by Bezalel. I mean, we don't know. When you say, and we all made
the very
it,
first
I don't know
thing,
where that is.
The very first thing that Aaron does when he tries to get out of trouble is to cut himself off from the causality of having created.
Yes.
Okay? But the story that tells us, the telling of it, the fashioning of it, is really, really evident. There's a lot being invested in telling that part of the story. Okay?
Can I just say one more thing? One more thing,
and then I'd like to cloud forward.
But biblical scholarship has suggested that there were two traditions which underlie the Torah text about the Exodus and all of the...
This is the quality, the category of quick questions, like the other.
Yeah, pertinent stuff. Anyway, and that the tabernacle that was built by Bezalel, which had on its cover the cherubim,
right.
That there was another tradition, the southern tradition, which had bulls in place of the cherub. And that essentially, that is suppressed because the northern tribes and the southern tribes entered into a kind of culture war as to whose traditions would prevail. And the winner was the northern with the cherubim. And so, anyway, this would take us far away.
But
there is another explanation for the image of the calf, which represents the terrible and apostasy. That's not our tradition, and that's the one, you know, we don't want to have.
Could be.
Okay, but that...
isn't it more than just calf? I mean, it's...
Let's find out what it is.
Wouldn't there have been a more powerful thing to have a full-grown bull? Why a little baby cow?
I have no idea. We can go there. We can go there. Let's hold off. Let's try to move a little bit forward. All right. I want to talk about power. I want to talk about power.
Okay.
I want to talk about these three things a little bit because they're crucial to understanding idolatry and they're crucial to answering our first question, which was: is there idolatry today? Is the second commandment still relevant? So let's go into these just a little bit. Power. Power is the number one source of idolatry. You wake up in the morning, you're a farmer in an ancient world, you're terrified that something horrible is going to happen to you, your children, your family. Okay, the world is run according to principles that you have no control over, and you have not yet invented drip irrigation. So here you go, you pray to whoever controls the rain, I'm going to pray to him. And whoever controls the sun, I'm going to pray to that, and whoever, and so on and so forth. Okay, the number one impetus for idolatry is trying to stay alive. We try to stay alive, we do whatever it takes. Okay? And this is really important. Because if you don't find a way to overcome that fear, you're never going to break through to some kind of a better world. Okay? We know of places in the world today where people live their lives entirely according to fear. Entirely according to a calculus of what's going to keep them alive for another day or month or year. And those places have a very difficult time getting past, you know, these fears to place, you know, and being able to talk about, you know, rights and freedoms and creativity and all the things that we see as the glory of our civilization. There are many places in the world where today these words are meaningless because people are saying, what do you want from me? I'm just trying to stay alive. This is why, first of all, you have this overwhelming statement on the part of God that he's a jealous God, and you know, and that he builds himself as this bully to try to overwhelm the force of the idolaters. First of all, because there's a power game being played here. In the minds of the idolaters, even if the idols are fake, in the mind of the idolater, there's a power game. If this God can prove to me that he's stronger and bigger than those other gods, then I won't worship those other gods. I'll worship this one. But there's more. Okay. There's a story that the rabbis tell about Abraham. Now, according to rabbinic tradition, Abraham discovered the problem of idolatry. Okay, you know this story? His father, Terach, was an idol maker. Okay, and according to the story, when Abraham was a child, his father left Abraham in charge of the store, and people came in to buy their idols, and he started making fun of them. He started saying, you know, this can't do that, and oh, this idol, we can't sell that because it just, you know, it just ran away with this other idol. You know, there's all these stories he makes up under the assumption, you know, that they're powerful, they're strong, so they can do all these things. And then one day, he just smashes them all, and when his father comes home, he says, what is going on? He says, well, this one big idol came and beat up all the other idols. His father didn't like it very much. He sent him, Abraham, off to deal with the local idol god king, whose name was Nimrod. And therein ensues, in the rabbinic tradition, the following debate between Nimrod and Abraham. Nimrod said to Abraham, let us worship the fire. Abraham said to him, if so, let us worship the water, which puts out the fire. Nimrod answered him, then let us worship the water. And Abraham said to him, if so, then let us worship the clouds. Right? Because the clouds carry the water. Nimrod said, so let us worship the clouds. And Abraham said to him, okay, if so, let us worship the wind, which disperses the clouds. Nimrod answered him, so let us worship the wind. And Abraham said to him, if so, let us worship man, who breathes the wind. Nimrod said to him, this is idle chatter. I will worship the fire after all, and I will throw you into it. Let the God whom you worship come and save you. Now, the story has a continuation, which I'll get to in a minute. But first of all, let's take a look at this text here. What is the nature? What's the underlying issue? What is Abraham trying to show Nimrod?
That there's something greater.
There's something greater than any given idol. Okay, what's the greatest thing that he gets to?
Man.
Okay, why is that the step that infuriates Nimrod? Okay, we get fire, water, clouds, wind, and man. Why is it that when he gets to man, Nimrod gets so upset?
Because that could be actually a rival to him, an actual rival.
Yeah.
all the natural elements, they're a little bit abstract, and frankly, they don't disturb the power structure or the cushy job that Nimrod's got. But when he comes down to man, that could actually be threatening.
How is it threatening?
Well, because if you're going to worship men, what do you need Nimrod for?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Exactly. What Abraham is doing here is he's ripping the mask off of idolatry, off of the power logic of the whole idolatrous world. The whole idolatrous world goes under the assumption that some guy comes to you and says, hey, I'm in charge of clouds. I'm the cloud guy. Okay, come to my temple. We got a temple, and you put money in the basket, and you say a few things to the clouds. I promise you the clouds will come on time. Okay? Idolatry was a mask for the power of people who were behind it. Okay? And what Abraham is doing is he's saying, you, God king, you're just a man. You're no God. All of this idolatry stuff is just people exercising their powers over other people. But it's all lies. According to the legend, the story goes on. Nimrod throws Abraham into the furnace. And Abraham comes out unscathed. God really does save him. Now, it turns out that his brother, Haran, was there too. Abraham's brother. And before they threw Abraham into the furnace, they said to Haran, what do you think? What side are you on? He says, However you want to go, if Abraham wins, I'm going to be on his side. And if Abraham loses, then I'll be on the other side. I'm okay either way. Abraham gets thrown into the furnace, comes out unscathed. Haran, having pledged his support for his brother, gets thrown into the furnace and dies. He crawls out and dies at the feet of his father Terah. What's that? What's going on in that happened story? Because it's really important for everything we're talking about. Why does Haran die?
He was a non-believer.
He was a non-believer. He believed in something. He believed in whoever won. He believed in Abraham. He said, I believe in Abraham. Because Abraham won.
He believed in everything. He believed in whoever comes out on top.
He believed in whoever comes out on top. He believed in power. He accepted the fundamental power logic of the idolaters. Even though he was accepting Abraham, that was going to be his, whatever Abraham said, Abraham's God, he's going to buy it. But because he accepted the fundamental logic of idolatry, then idolatry, the idolatrous furnace is what killed him. Why does he die at the feet of his father? Because his father based his life on the power, in his case, of selling, making and selling idols. So there's a fundamental power issue. And I would suggest to you, that the first of the three things that are at issue here are power, is power. Power is the first great distractor. The first thing that makes us not be able to judge right from wrong. The first thing that distorts our moral judgment. We live a life in which we know that there's a right and wrong, because we have a tradition that teaches us that, of a right and wrong. But in real life experiences, we're constantly making calculations vis-a-vis powers that threaten us. Okay? This is the most powerful thing there is. This is the reason why, in my humble opinion, Jewish tradition believes in reward and punishment for sins, right? Because we need something to enter into that power calculation. Because otherwise there's no way in the world to get a whole nation of people to actually believe in trying to do things for reasons other than power. You want people to believe that they should be good even when it's against their best interests? Then you have to create some kind of a belief structure that counterbalances that calculus with some kind of otherworldly. I'm not saying whether it's true or false or anything. I'm just saying I believe that there's a vital role that is played by these beliefs in reward and punishment. In Judaism. Power. Secondly, the second great distractor, the second thing that makes it very hard for us to see right from wrong, the thing that draws us in, is beauty. Now this is, you know, this is an easy one. It's, right? Like I could go on forever about, you know, the worship of models and you know, in our society and how beauty is all there is and everything like that. What I'd like to do though, instead, is oh gosh, I skipped it. All right, I'll go back to it later. Is give you a little quote. Okay, just a little background here. One of the most interesting things, fashion statements being made in the Bible, has to do with the high priests, who most of the year wear garments of gold, but on Yom Kippur, right, they take off those garments of gold and they wear garments of white. Okay? It's fascinating. Just, it's very, very interesting, because on the one hand, there's an affirmation of the aesthetics and of beauty, and of the idea that that person who's sort of worshiping on behalf of us in the temple and conducting the greatest worships, it's got to look really good. But then on Yom Kippur, they go to white. Rabbi Simon said in the name of Rabbi Yoshua, why does the high priest not enter the Holy of Holies in his garments of gold on Yom Kippur? To avoid feeding arguments to Satan, who, in trying to get God to punish Israel, might say, hey, yesterday they worshipped gods of gold, and today they want to serve you in garments of gold? What does this mean? What is that story? What is that? Okay, I might have a subtle agenda here throughout these sessions, which is to convince everybody that wacky rabbinic stories are actually philosophical teachings. So every time we hit something like that, I'm going to say, what on earth is going on here? What is being taught? What's the underlying philosophical message that's being taught by feeding arguments to Satan and gold? What's this about?
It's about hypocrisy a bit.
Okay.
Because if we saying that gold, you know, we look, is something that's is a symbol of something, the golden calf is a symbol of something bad, of something wrong. But on the other hand, they're wearing gold, which is also a very showing off and glittering and gold. So there's a sort of parallel here of a certain hypocrisy where there it's not allowed, but we can. We're allowed.
There's something. Yeah, so
well, the rabbinic phrase that sums up the idea is Eino sin kategor sanigor. That is, you can't use some element for defense, which at one time was an element that condemns you.
In other words, you did something bad with gold. Don't try to use it on the day that you're supplicating to God and being your purest.
Because what God's going to think about gold, when did I last see gold? Oh, that was the golden calf.
Right? So there's a visual association, there's an unconscious psychological association that God has, and presumably we do too, between the sin of the calf and that its representation in gold. Okay. The Bible talks about statues, about idols, as works of gold and silver, over and over and over again. The attractiveness, the visual pull of the beauty of the calf is something that we are being warned against on some level. Okay? There is no, it's not. Don't get me wrong, okay? The Bible is not anti-power, it's not anti-beauty, and it's not anti-creativity in the works of our hands. However, there is a certain pull by these features, certain thing that pulls us, that draws us, that if we feed it, we just can't stop. Okay? Beautiful people are great, and beauty is great, right? The priest wears golden garments all year long. But when the chips are down, when we're at our most intimate with God, when we are at our most exposed and vulnerable to God, that's when we have to make sure we're not hiding behind beauty. That's how we have to. That's the point at which you know whether or not you've crossed the line into the idolatry of beauty.
For me, the beauty is a bracha, a blessing, that when you see something beautiful, instead of moving into it, becoming, worshiping it in a sense, what do? You bring it back to the source.
Right, you make a blessing
what
to God.
What a beautiful way to disconnect
by the way,
from that.
You do the same thing when you see a ruler. Mm-hmm. OK? okay, when you see a ruler of a country, you make a blessing to God. Okay?
It breaks the spell.
It breaks the spell, it says, God makes the beautiful, God makes the powerful. Okay, they're not...
Why did they choose to have the high priest dressed in gold? Would have been easier.
It would have been easier to deny beauty entirely.
No, but you can be beautiful without gold.
But why make beautiful things at all? No, gold is just an extreme example of beauty. Some people would argue that other things are more beautiful. Mm-hmm. But gold, gold is the ultimate artifact of beauty, as opposed to natural beauty. Why not just do away with beauty? Why not just say the things of this earth, the powerful and the beautiful, they're an illusion, they're false. All beauty is false. Why not say that? After all, when some people are blessed and lucky to be beautiful, some people are not so lucky, and the result is that there's a certain unfairness, after all. What do we need beauty for?
Well, one thing beauty is good for is to indicate that someone is healthy, they're probably strong, they probably will be able to live, and the whole point, as you're saying, is that the fear of having their life extinguished by a hostile world seems to lie behind idolatry. Mm-hmm. So if you have beautiful fruit, it's probably healthy fruit. It's good to eat.
There are a lot of theories about beauty, which we won't get into right now, but this is a very powerful one of them, is the connection between life, the affirmation of life, and our understandings of beautiful. Beautiful people, things, fruits, tend to be more healthy looking, more, if it's sexual, then sexuality is also reproductive and fruitful and so forth. There's a life affirmation that is behind beauty.
And we flaunt it, you shank it because I live here, but yeah. Just walk through shanking and you'll see everybody, not everybody, but the attempt, especially when you're younger, right, looking for a mate, is to, in whatever way you perceive to be effectively incurring interest, however it is.
Interest in you, first of all, as a reproducing being.
Yes, of course.
Okay. On the question of the high priests, let's leave aside our prejudices, our modern outlooks. The high priest and the priestly class in general is fundamentally a symbolic role. Okay, it symbolizes all of the stuff going on in the tabernacle, all of that worship, it's all symbolic. The priests could not worship. What are the conditions for worship, for a priest to be worshiping in the tabernacle? He can't be deformed. He can't be missing limbs. He can't have his sexual organs can't be malformed. It says it explicitly. Can't be fundamentally diseased. Okay. It would not have passed the tests laid out by the Americans with Disabilities Act. However, it is symbolic of something very, very deep running throughout the Bible, and that is the affirmation of life and beauty as a corollary to the affirmation of life as part of our worship of God. We're going to get to life when we get to this, to the sixth commandment, so I don't want to stay on it too long. I want to go forward. Okay, and of course, the famous line from the Shema prayer, do not stray after your hearts and after your eyes, which you go whoring after, so that you shall remember and perform all my commandments, right? This idea that our eyes pull us away from a sense of righteousness and justice. And that we end up with soul glow. Okay? You all know soul glow.
No.
Okay. Soul glow is fake. It's a fake product from a movie. Anyway, the point is, never mind. Okay.
Wrong generation.
The works of our hands. This is my favorite one. It's my favorite one because it's in many ways very unintuitive. We create things, and we have a natural pull to worship the things we create. Okay? That distracts us as powerfully as power and as powerfully as beauty, the works of our hands. How many times do the prophets describe the idols as ma'aseh yedei adam, right? The works of men, of people's hands, of men's hands. Okay? We write books. We build houses. We build businesses. We raise children. And we have a tendency, deep down inside, to worship that, to worship whatever it is that we've made. Okay? Here's what Isaiah has to say. Talks about somebody takes a piece of wood. Okay? Half of it he burns in the fire. With this half of it, he eats meat. He roasts the roast, and he is satisfied. Indeed, he warms himself against the fire and says, aha, I am warm, I have seen the fire. And of the rest of it, he makes a god, his carved idol. He falls down to it and worships it and prays to it and says, deliver me, for you are my God. A deceived heart has turned him aside that he cannot deliver his soul, nor say, is there not a lie in my right hand? Okay, there's something preposterous about idols. You make something and then declare it a god? What are you worshiping? What are you worshiping when you worship the works of your hands? You're worshiping
yourself.
You're worshiping yourself.
And in the image of
God. You're doing, just as this Abraham said when he revealed the fact, when he took that mask off of Nimrod and said, no, all idolatry is ultimately a worship of man. Okay?
Yeah. Maybe a better proof text is from Deuteronomy, where Moses, in his admonishment to the people, says to them, and if you do well, you will, by God, you will succeed in your, have many, many riches, etc. And then, beware, because lest you forget God, and you say, Kochi ve'otzem yadi asalid kolel.
Which in English is? In English?
I did it.
Okay, that's the big danger. All right? From the perspective of the prophets, there's something ridiculous about it. This is their way of fighting this particular aspect, is to expose the, is to ridicule it. Right? Satire. To say, to tell a story and say, look, this is just ridiculous. And yet people do it very naturally. Okay? The idols, we read in Psalms, are the works of men's hands. They have mouths but cannot speak. They have eyes but cannot see. They have ears but cannot hear, noses but cannot smell, hands but cannot feel, legs but cannot walk. Their throats utter not a word. Those who make them or trust in them shall become like them. Okay? The effect of worshiping the works of your hands is that you become little more than that. You become a book, you become an iPad, you become a little bronze statue. Those are the things you become because you can't see beyond them. Now, again, creativity, creation, that's not, the Bible isn't anti-creativity. I mean, the first thing God does is he creates and creates and creates. Right? It's not about being anti-creativity. It's about seeing that every single piece of the puzzle of life, the power and the beauty and works of our hands, every single one of these things is fundamentally limited. Okay? And the moment we let it take over our conscience, that's when we cross the line into idolatry. Now, how do I know I'm right about my theory? First of all, because I said so. Yeah. I know I'm right because after the golden calf, Moses punishes the Israelites. And he punishes them. You know, the smashing of the tablets, maybe that's part of their punishment, but that's what it is. He smashes the tablets because the tablets are fundamentally irrelevant and irreconcilable with the situation in which the Israelites are worshiping the golden calf. But he does three things. Three things he does as punishment to the Israelites. What are they? First thing he does. That's the second thing he does. You know what? Let's call it the first thing because it fits my three things in a row. First thing he does. Okay, ignore the fact that the verses are out of order. Power. And Moses said, who is on the Lord's side? Right, let him come to me, and all the Levites gather around him. Put every man his sword by his side, go to and fro from gate to gate throughout the camp, and slay every man his brother. And right, and he goes, he kills, with help of the Levites, 3,000 men. Why does he do this? What's the point?
Punishment.
Punishment? Maybe.
It's a reassertion of his power.
The reassertion of his power. It's a political move. There has been a, first of all, think purely pure power politics. There has been a coup. He has come down from the mountain and no longer has political authority. He must reestablish his political authority through force. Through force. Okay? That's number one. Power. There's a power logic to idolatry. He must win. God has to win. Okay, Moses is carrying God's message. If Moses doesn't win, then everything that's happened up till now has been completely pointless. They might have stayed, as well have stayed in Egypt. He has to win. He has to reassert power. He has to be in charge again. Second, beauty. And the Lord said to Moses, say to the children of Israel, you are a stiff-necked people. Therefore now put off your ornaments from you, that I might know what to do. And the children of Israel stripped themselves of their ornaments. They mount Horeb. This is the part of the reaction and response that is very often forgotten. God makes the Israelites take off their jewelry. From here on, you're going to be walking plain. Okay? Beauty? We're not going to talk about that right now because you worship the beautiful. And third, of course, and he took the calf which they had made, and he burnt it in the fire, and he ground it to powder, and he scattered it upon the water, and he made the children of Israel drink of it. Okay? These verbs, these active doing verbs that represent the precise mirror image of the verbs that Aaron was using to build the calf. He showed them that just as our hands make things, our hands can also destroy them. And why did he make them drink it? We mentioned this last week. Why go that far?
Internalize it.
Yeah, those who make them or trust in them shall become like them. Okay, this is going into your body. You are you are it. You made it, now you're it.
You think there's kind of an allusion or some kind of hidden reference to Sota here?
Maybe. The waters that the woman who's accused of adultery has to drink, the special waters of Sota, and if she is guilty, then she dies. And if she's not guilty, then she lives. Look, I have to say yes. And the reason I have to say yes is because throughout many parts of the prophetic text, when Israel is idolatrous, it's likened to an adulterous
wife. Right.
Okay, idolatry and adultery are symbolically bound up for a very simple reason. Right? God and Israel are intimate. Okay, the Bible is very much about the intimacy between God and Israel. Okay, there is, in the temple, according to rabbinic tradition, in the temple in Jerusalem, the Holy of Holies was adorned with sexual imagery. Okay, representing the intimacy between God and Israel. So I wouldn't at all be surprised if there's some kind of a reference being made here to the adultery question. Okay, I want to take a little, I mean, this is really sort of it, right? You've got these three powerful things all coming together to represent this concept of idolatry, where the ban on idols is essentially saying there is a good, there is a better, there is, you know, we just asserted making this world better, is the purpose of the whole Ten Commandments, whatever the definition is. But first of all, in order to have that kind of statement, you have to be able to assert with confidence that there is a better. Okay? And that it's beyond the most obvious things. It's beyond the things that pull us. It's there. So you have power, you have beauty, you have the works of our hands, all coming together, symbolized in idolatry, symbolized in the golden calf. And it's overcoming, symbolized by the second commandment. That basically covers that. Before we go on to the third commandment, let's open it up a little bit. I know that we've already spoken a lot, but let's talk about the iPad. Let's go there. Okay, I kept saying I didn't want to go there. Let's go there. I'm sorry, what's your name again?
Shoshi.
Tell me about the iPad.
The iPad is a beautiful creation. I mean, in itself it might not be beautiful, but if you look at where computers started from, it became a thing of beauty. It gives you a lot of power because you have the world at your fingertips. You have all the knowledge you want. As soon as you log in, you can get any information you need. You can be in touch with anybody you need. You can investigate anything you want. The sky's the limit. So that's the beauty. It makes you powerful. What was the third thing?
Works of our hands.
Works of our hands. Well, Steve Jobs was just a genius. I mean, that's undisputed. And we have come to worship it. People can't go very far without it. People don't want to be without it. And people who don't have it aspire to get it.
I just read today an article that there's a newspaper in Brooklyn which has been tracking thefts of iPhones in its various different, like they've been following the police blotters in throughout the different precincts in Brooklyn. And the article, this is, I think it might be in the New York Times today, maybe I saw it somewhere else, I don't know. It talks about how the iPhone has become this incredible symbol of the thing that people who don't have it really want, people who do have it take for granted, and can be so easily stolen from people. You know, even as they're using it, in the middle of getting off a subway in broad daylight, someone runs by and snatches it, that it becomes a certain kind of a barometer of a certain problem in society, in, you know, the extent to which people are, you know, the tension is building up between those people who can, who are in that part of society where it's obvious that you have it, it's taken for granted, and those people in other parts of society.
It's also become the standard bearer. That's the thing that people try to knock off, to emulate.
Do other people agree with this characterization of the iPad, the iPhone, as a mm-hmm. as an idolatrous?
Not in of itself.
The spokesman for the only existing iPad in the room. The floor.
Not in and of itself. It's what, nothing here is idolatrous unless you make it so.
Okay.
So in and of itself, it's an amazing electronic phenomenon, but what you, how you relate to it is what makes it an idol.
Of course.
Well, yeah, I'm not...
But do you agree that it's become
What's
that for a lot of people?
What's the first thing you do after Shabbat is over?
What?
What's the first thing you do after Shabbat is over? Turn all your lights on.
Yeah. No, I'm...
We check our email.
Yeah, I don't know.
Used to be light a cigarette.
Yeah, listen.
It's great to leave certain things for other people to say. I didn't want to say that.
I've been struggling with this whole thing. After I read this article about this new documentary that came out about this and I've been really struggling with that because there's always that urge to want to find out. I'm not quite sure after a while what I'm really trying to find out. To be, how many times can I look at the J Post and YNET and Haaretz and this and that? I mean, I've seen it, but there's an urge that I'm maybe missing something.
How many? Anybody here own a Kindle?
Yes.
I do, which I never open.
Yes.
Okay. You all know what a Kindle is?
Yeah.
Okay.
I have it on here, too.
No, you don't.
Yes, I do.
No, you don't. I'm not talking about I'm not talking about the software of Kindle. I'm talking about the machine, the physical object. What's incredibly important, I mean, sorry to sort of get off on technological issues, but what's incredibly interesting that distinguishes a Kindle from an iPad is that a Kindle is what we call a dedicated device. Okay? It's something that's just for reading. You can't check your email on it. You can't check stock prices. You can't look what to see what time Shabbos is coming in or going out or whatever. All it's for is for reading.
Yeah, but there's a problem with Kindle that my companion has. He can't use it on Shabbos.
Well, Kindle is also not backlit, so there's a whole physiological element involved as well. And you could argue that having a backlit screen does something to you that makes you feel good.
I'm not going to go there, although I could just spend the whole rest of the evening talking about what you just raised. So I'm not going to. I'm going to resist the temptation. The only reason I mentioned it is that there is something about there's something very compelling about having all that power in your hands. There's something that pulls you away from anything you might have planned on doing. That it distracts you. That's the simple
word.
Okay?
If it doesn't last until something new comes up. You know, it's, I mean, that's the whole thing with these fashion things. Suddenly iPod and then iPad, then something becomes a trend that everybody becomes obsessive.
But it's the information.
There's a step, it's escalating. So even if it becomes something new, it's going to be better. Even more.
You get a stimulus. There's a stimulation that comes, yeah.
So I see in my own children, my grandchildren, because are totally taken over by it. Mm-hmm. When they enter into the world of the iPad, they block out everything else in the world. And you can't talk to them. Literally cannot talk to them. And you have to drag them away from it because it's so consuming.
But they're brighter than us because of that.
What?
They're brighter than us.
Well,
at a younger age, they can do things that grandchildren can do.
But at an older age, I don't know if they can do things that we can do.
Isn't it interesting that there's a...
But that for me is the power and the beauty and the...
Professor Rabbi passed away recently, a really good friend, Moshe Troy, is a futurist too. Many, many years. He said... Part of the dilemma in high tech is that the more high tech you have, the more virtual, the more high touch you need. The problem is that it draws you so far away from your body that you don't even realize how much you really need touch. And he says that's going to be the tension. That's the tension that's taking place now and will be for the future because ultimately if you move further, further away from that contact, right? I mean, today you go to a restaurant, first thing I look is to see a number of young people together, and they're not with each other. They're with their whatever, their iPad, their phone, whatever. But the point being is that once you come back into the high touch, there's almost, you move back into your own humaneness, your own humanity, and then realizing the physical needs that you've kind of lost.
There's no question that technology is going to, in some ways, because of its very empowering features, is going to force many human beings to try to rediscover certain things that were evident and apparent to previous generations. All right, but it goes many different ways. Right, I'll just give you an example. This week, my sister-in-law returned from her vacation trip in Thailand. Okay, now she's a little sister in the army. And she spent her entire 2 weeks in Thailand, every single day, was sending SMSs to her sister in Israel in the army. Now, on the one hand, there's something horrible about that, because we've reached a point in life in which there's no such thing as going to Thailand and experiencing what it's like to completely cut yourself off from everything you left, because you're constantly in communication with the very people that you left. On the other hand, at the same time, there's something very nice about the fact that she's constantly sharing with her sister in real time experiences from the other side of the planet. technology by itself, just like power by itself, just like all of these things, in and of itself, is not bad. I don't believe any of us really would go back in time, technologically, 50 years or 100 years, not to speak of 1,000 years. Okay? We live longer, more productive, more healthy lives if we choose to. However, and this is the big however that is the focus of everything we're trying to say. However, there is a human core, a moral core, a very powerful moment of who we are that always, always, always has to be independent of the things that are pulling it. It has to be incredibly strong, strong enough to take the very Ten Commandments and destroy them when necessary, strong enough to grind a golden calf into powder, strong enough to stand outside of it all and say there is good, there is bad, all of these things have their place in the world, but we as moral human beings have an obligation constantly to be stepping back and saying, you know, which really are the gods that brought us out of Egypt? Let's talk a little bit about the third commandment. We do have only 5 sessions and 10 commandments, so it unfortunately, I don't believe we're going to have enough time to really, really do the third commandment justice, but we should talk a little bit about integrity.
What's the word that they say in integrity in Hebrew?
How do you say integrity in Hebrew?
Yosher.
Yosher, Yoshra. These are modern Hebrew has a few words for it. I think Yosher is closest to the biblical because it says over and over again, V'asita et ha-yashar b'enei Adonai. You should do that which is right, straight. Yashar means straight in the eyes of God. Well, first of all, let's just do let's look at the text. Right? A reader, someone read it out loud with verve. You have it? Verve?
You shall not invoke the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord shall not hold blameless one who invokes his name in vain.
Okay. Last week, somebody explained what this means. Did you? Somebody explained, maybe she's not here. Right, she was the young one who wasn't here. Who isn't here now? What is this about? First of all, what we call pshat, right? The simple reading of the text. What is this talking about?
Expression.
Right? Is it talking about saying God's name on the radio?
Bleed neder. That's right.
Bleed neder. Right? What does bleed neder mean?
Without.
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 Without making an oath.
Yeah.
Okay. Invoking the name of God is about making oaths. Okay. Did you ever notice that, like? The word for profanity, the verb for being profane in English is to
swear
or to curse. Right? Both swearing and cursing have these powerful biblical resonances to them, right? Ancient resonances. To swear is to take an oath. Right? Nobody who uses the F word is taking an oath, nor are they usually invoking a curse on somebody. I mean, sometimes they are. But sometimes they're just talking. Even the word profanity is religious, as opposed to sanctity, right? The profane is that which is not holy. Okay, so that whole line of attitudes to certain words resonates back to a time when there were holy words. And holy words were what you do when you take an oath. You invoke the name of God. Or, alternatively, invoke the name of some other guy, right? Right? There are all these stories, rabbinic stories, where a rabbi is talking to somebody who's not Jewish, and they swear by the dome in Rome, right? Kippah shel Rom, right? You know, or even in modern Hebrew, p'chayecha. Okay, what does p'chayecha mean? On your life. Okay? I swear on you swear on whatever you hold dearest. So it's about oaths. It's about false oaths. It's about vain oaths, which is another way of saying a false oath, right? Something when you say something and it doesn't carry the weight, it disappears. It's meaningless. It's vain. Right? Shav is the Hebrew word, the shav. It's, you know, in vain. Why is this one of the commandments? Why is not swearing false oaths one of the commandments? We don't swear oaths at all. I mean, again, it's another one of these, you know, Christopher Hitchens will come and say, look, it's another one of these, you know, this vainglorious God who just needs to always protect his honor, and here he is again protecting his honor. Why is this important?
Well, so as not to transform the sacred into the
profane. So
as to separate between those two worlds.
What's an oath? What? Why do you swear oaths ever? What's your purpose in swearing?
Make a commitment.
Promise.
Truth.
Promise.
Truth.
Okay, an oath is what you do when you say, what I'm about to say now is really, 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 really true. Not like the other things I say other times, which are sometimes true and sometimes, you know, they're sort of half true. Here, so help me God, is a true statement. Whether it be a promise, a statement about the past, a statement about current intentions, right? Oaths can be you swear, take an oath in court when you provide testimony. There's something, it's about truth. It's about truthfulness. It's about not lying. It's about integrity. Now, you will all notice that the most famous of the Ten Commandments that does not actually exist in the Ten Commandments, right? The one that everybody knows, kind of thinks is supposed to be there, but for some reason isn't, is this one. Right? Thou shalt not lie. Right, there is no commandment, thou shalt not lie. It doesn't exist. Okay? Everyone thinks, like, you know, that you hear it, and you just sort of think, oh, that's probably one of the... No, it's not there. Okay? There is a prohibition, there's a statement, there's a mitzvah, right, in the Bible, in the Torah, that says, midvar sheker tirchak, right? Stay away from things that are false, are lying. Lying words. Dva, remember the word eser tadvarim, right? From the big utterances, from the utterance, from a lying utterance, stay away. Distance yourself. Which is very different from thou shalt not lie. Right? It seems to suggest that maybe there's some times when lying isn't so bad. Right? It seems to suggest that lying, there's like distance variables. According to the rabbis, there are three times when you're permitted to lie. One of them is when you're asked about your personal or sexual or things that are of a very intimate personal nature that are simply none of the business of the person who's asking, and you're allowed to lie about them. A second instance in which you're allowed to lie is when you are asked whether or not you have learned a certain tractate of the Talmud, and you would like to hide the extent of your learning for reasons of modesty. So you're allowed to say, no, that I haven't learned, even if you have already learned it. According to the rabbis, the third instance in which you're allowed to lie is if you are approached by a groom on his wedding day and asked, what do you think about my bride?
I just was with her.
There are clearly, on the one hand, times in which the utterance of a falsehood is a good thing. And yet at the same time, I can say that, at the same time, we know how easy it is to go from that fact all the way to just say whatever you want. When I was 19 years old, I had a summer job selling timeshare condominiums. Okay? Now...
That's a lie. That's a lying business.
Wow. Wow, you have no idea. You have no idea.
I do. Something okay. Tried to sell me. Maybe it was you.
Let me tell you about this, okay? First, the condominiums were in Stowe, Vermont.
A nice place.
We were in Framingham, Massachusetts. Okay? Now, we've been up there. We've gone to the place in Stowe, Vermont. It existed. It looked nice. As far as we could tell from a two-night visit, it was a wonderful place. Here we are in Framingham, in a center. We send out these postcards, and we tell people, come in and hear our presentation. You'll get a computer or a television. Even if you make no commitment at all, you will get a computer or a television. These people came, and our job was to spend 3 full hours trying to get them to sign on a piece of paper that commits them to $8,000 or $10,000 in exchange for 1 week out of a year, not a rental, but vacation ownership. Okay, which means you get a deed, and you can even pass it on to your children forever, owning 1 week out of every year in a place in Stowe, Vermont. And not only that, but you also get to be part of our international network of resorts. And every year you can trade that week in Stowe, Vermont for a week in Cancun or Acapulco or wherever you want to go. On the first day, the sales manager said to us the following words. I will simply never forget this. He said, you may lie about anything except the product. The product.
No, not the price.
Right, except the things that you are selling, things that will risk a lawsuit. That you can't lie about. Anything else? It's all yours. So what did we do? We salespeople, all of us were, you know, like one or two of the people on the sales force were like long time. So everyone else was just doing it as a summer gig, you know. And there was this woman from Scotland, and there was me who visited Israel, and there was, you know, another guy who had like, you know, been in the military. And every single one of these people had stories to tell. And we just shared our stories, and by the time we got to the clients, every single one of us had been to Tel Aviv, had been to Sicily, had been to all these places and resorts, and had stories to tell that were... Now, looking back, I just think, wow. Imagine that some sucker comes in and wants his TV, and he sees this 19-year-old kid claiming to have been in a resort in, like, you know, the Caribbean, and it just was completely absurd. And at the end of the 3 hours, whether they bought or not, they got something that was just close enough to being called a television or a computer as to be something that could conceivably stand up in court. Okay? But whether it actually televised or computed, open questions. There's a very powerful cultural problem throughout the West, which is somehow bullshitting is not seen as lying. It's not seen as a problem. A deep, deep problem. You're not sure that I'm right? Let's ask this man. Who is that? Who is that man on the bike by the beach? Don't you recognize him? Surely you must recognize him. That's Arnold Schwarzenegger. That is Arnold Schwarzenegger. Okay, today, it's Arnold Schwarzenegger in this current November 2011 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. Okay? Now, here's a little story.
Vanity Fair.
Yes, this is one of my favorite. Okay. Speaking of vanity and the shot of vain, this is one of my favorite magazines, which I will explain to anyone who's interested to know why. It's the only one I have a subscription to. And it has to be in print. I would never read it on one of those things. Anyway, here's what Arnold Schwarzenegger did. A little story that he tells Michael Lewis. You know Michael Lewis, author of The Blind Side and all these other great books. You're just going through, talking about this. I just found this, you know, this week. He's talking about when he first came to America. He was a bodybuilder, he had these muscles, and he was working together with this Italian guy who himself was also, had won the World's Strongest Man competition. And the two of them together went into business building, you know, like masonry, like building walls. Here's the story he tells. They had a routine. Franco would play the unreliable Italian. Arnold, the sober German. Before they cut any deal, they'd scream at each other in German in front of the customer, until the customer would finally ask what was going on. Arnold would turn to the customer and explain, "Oh, he's Italian, and you know how they are. He wants to charge you more, but I think we can do it cheaply." Schwarzenegger would then name a not-so-cheap price. And the customer, he says now laughing, he would always say, "Arnold, you're such a nice guy, so honest." It was selling, you know. Okay, this, now, you get the problem? The problem is that a man who has made it, has been tremendously successful, who became the governor of California, is now, he's past his political career, he might be past his acting career, and now he can sort of tell all. You know, it was so funny. We just made up this stuff, and it was great, and it was selling, you know? So I take these two stories and I say, wow, there's a real problem. And my claim is that the fundamental purpose of the third commandment, it's not to destroy and do away with all lies, all falsehoods ever spoken out of our mouths. What it does, on the contrary, it's almost on the defensive. It says, there has to be one place on earth, one moment in life in which words can be reliable. The falsehood is a given. That's human nature. But if everything is false, then there is no chance of redemption. There is no chance of better. There is no chance of anything ever emerging from this swamp of human existence. Right? This world filled with, what was the word in the time of Noah? Hamas. Right? The hope of breaking out of the cycle of the timeshare salesman and the Schwarzenegger salesman is if we can believe that at least at one point, at least when someone makes an oath, we can count on the truth of those words. From there, we can build outwards. Now, the Bible actually speaks a lot about truthfulness and falsehood. There are just some incredible passages where it turns out with Jeremiah, I think it's Jeremiah, for example, says, you know, here, Jeremiah. Right? He basically says that falsehood is the key problem that led to the destruction of the first temple, the destruction of civilization. Right? What's the destruction of the first temple? It's the destruction of all hope in the world for the creation of some kind of a good society based on God's promise and the commandments and all that stuff was embodied in this first kingdom. And according to Jeremiah, what destroyed it? Here are the words that Jeremiah puts into God's mouth, or the other way around. "Oh, that I were in the wilderness, in a lodging place of wayfaring men, that I might leave my people and go from them. For they bend their tongues, they bow their bow, right? They bend their bow of falsehood. But they are not valiant for the truth upon the earth, for they proceed from evil to evil, and they know me not, says the Lord. Take heed, every one of his neighbor, and trust not in any brother, for every brother acts deceitfully, and every neighbor goes about with slanders. And they deceive everyone his neighbor, and do not speak the truth. Therefore, so says the Lord of hosts, behold, I will smelt them and try them." Okay? He's saying that but he's not talking about humanity in general. He's talking about this group of people that I'm living among today. This kingdom is going to be destroyed because they are liars. Okay, there's a rabbinic tale, and again, we have a little problem, right? The problem is, we know it's not all falsehood, because the rabbis tell us, because obviously you can lie to there are times when you're allowed to lie. So what is it? If it's not about not lying, per se, what is this concept of integrity? There's a rabbinic story of Rabbi Safra. Rabbi Safra put a notice in whatever was the equivalent of Janglo at the time, saying, "I'm selling something." The story doesn't even say what he was selling. He was selling something. A man shows up at his door, knocks on the door, lets himself in, And there is Rabbi Safra in the middle of his prayers. According to the tradition, he was saying the Shema prayer. The man walks in and says, I'll give you 100 for it. Rabbi Safra doesn't say a word. He's in the middle of his prayers. The man mistakes his silence for bargaining and says, all right, 200. Still, the rabbi says nothing. He says, 300, that's it, 300. The rabbi finishes his prayers and says to him, I'm going to give it to you for 100 because that's what I resolved to myself. That was what I decided when you made that offer. And I couldn't say anything, I accepted. And therefore, I will accept, I will take only 100 for it. Okay, now this is a story that's being presented as some kind of an ideal of integrity. You will notice that it has nothing to do with the words that are being said. Okay? Integrity isn't necessarily about words. I want to say a couple more stories because this goes on. There are two crucial stories. The Bible talks about integrity, honesty, as a certain kind of representation of yourself in the world. A truthful representation. Okay, not necessarily with words, but in the you that you present to the world as being real and true and honest. There are stories about, and there are two specific foci, focuses of stories, right? In addition to just saying people should be honest, people should be honest, and laws about honesty and honest dealings, there are a few sets of stories that you have to say, wow, there's something really important going on here. In one case, you have stories about keeping your promises. Okay? Keeping your promises. That is to say, when you say something for the future, that also is a truthful statement. Who's the biggest, most important promise keeper in the whole Bible? Sorry?
God.
Okay? My favorite God promise keeping story, of course, which is on page 82. You know, we said last week that God is not this like serene, perfect, you know, being in the Bible, but rather he's very, very human. What happens when he gets really mad at the Israelites, right? You're in the desert, you have the golden calf. Right after the golden calf, what does God say? He says, Moses, get out of the way. Because I'm coming through, and I'm going to kill them all, and I'm going to start all over again with you. Let's look at the actual text. And the Lord said to Moses, I have seen this people, and it is a stiff-necked people. Now leave me, and my anger will burn at them, and I will destroy them, and I will make of you a great nation instead. And Moses beseeched before the Lord God, his God, and he said, why shall the Lord be angry at your people that you took out of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand? Return from your anger, restrain the evil on your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore, saying to them, I shall multiply your seed like the stars in heaven and all this land that I have spoken of, and I shall give it to your offspring, and they shall inherit it forever. And the Lord repented from the evil which he had spoken of doing to his people. Okay. Later on, this story repeats itself, and then Moses says, you know, why should all the nations of the earth look at you and say, ah, you just tricked them, pulled them into the desert to kill them there. Okay, instead of fulfilling his promise. Okay, fulfilling the promise was such a powerful argument that it got God to change his mind. Okay, we have the entire arc of the story having to do with God's promise and his fulfillment of his promise, or Israel's non-fulfillment of the promise. Promise keeping is a big deal. But there's another big deal, another facet of integrity and honesty that's in some ways the most telling, the most interesting in terms of the biblical stories. And that has to do with admitting guilt about the past. And here I want to mention two stories. I'll try to do it briefly. First, of course, is the story of Judah and Tamar. Right? Judah, the fourth son of Jacob via Leah, he is the son that is destined to become the line of the greatest kings of Israel, right? The kingdom, the line of David and Solomon, the Davidic line, leading all the way, according to rabbinic tradition, to the Messiah in the future, are descendants of Judah. The scepter shall not depart from Judah. That's Jacob's blessing. So any story that's about Judah is important and interesting. But there's only one story about Judah in which Judah is by himself and not with all of his brothers and interacting with his other brothers. And that is the story of Judah and Tamar. Tamar is his daughter-in-law. He has three sons. Okay, the first son dies. She marries the second son. Second son also dies. Okay, that doesn't look so good, right? Judah's like, oh God. And she wants to marry the third son. He says, oh, when he comes of age, okay, you can marry him, sure, because what's, you know. And in the end, he marries Shah off to somebody else. And she's really mad, right, because he broke his promise. So he's on a trip down south, and she dresses up as a prostitute, seduces him, takes, as a deposit against payment, takes his ring, his cloak, and his staff. These are one translation of the three items. Wicks, some people say. We'll just say it's a ring, a cloak, and a staff. And when he comes the next day to deliver the payment to the prostitute, she's gone. No one's ever heard of her. No one's ever seen her before. She vanishes. Okay? Later on, a few months down the road, it emerges that Tamar is pregnant. Okay? And he says, look, she doesn't have a husband. Suddenly she's pregnant. Okay? She's a whore. And he says, take her out and let her be burned. So then she plays her hand. She sent word to her father-in-law saying, to the man who owns these things, I am with child. And she said, do you recognize these? To whom do this ring, this cloak, and this staff belong? And Judah recognized them, and he said, she is more righteous than I, for it is I who did not give her to Shelah, my son. Okay, this is the Judah story. And it is, in some ways, the absolute crucial marker for his right to hold the kingship. Okay, we can assume that the stories of the tribal patriarchs are literary foreshadowing of things that happen farther along in the Bible, especially when you're talking about Judah.
Especially true when the first three are disqualified.
Now let's take a look at two absolutely crucial stories, one about Saul and one about David. Okay, stories that are so parallel as to be clearly deliberate. The story of Saul, King Saul is the first king of Israel. He's given an order by God to go and battle the Amalekites. The Amalek is the permanent, you know, evil force in the world. And he's told to go destroy all the Amalekites, destroy their cattle, destroy their king, kill everybody. He goes and he does almost all of it. He doesn't kill all the sheep, and he saves, and he doesn't really kill the king either, sort of keeps him captive. And Samuel, the prophet, comes to him and says, what on earth is going on here? Now, this is a long and bizarre dialogue, and it's worth quoting in its entirety because you have to get the feel for it to understand what is being taught here. And Samuel came to Saul, and Saul said, blessed are you to the Lord. I have fulfilled the word of the Lord. And Samuel said, so what is that? What is this voice of sheep in my ears and the voice of cattle that I hear? And Saul said, they were taken from the Amalekites. The people desired the best of the sheep and cattle to offer as a sacrifice to the Lord your God. The rest we destroyed. And Samuel said, though you may be as a small child in your own eyes, you were made the chief of all the tribes of Israel. And the Lord anointed you king over Israel. And the Lord sent you on a mission and said to you, go and destroy the sinful Amalek and fight them until they are utterly consumed. So why did you not listen to the voice of the Lord, but instead leapt upon the spoils and thus did evil in the eyes of the Lord? And Saul said, but I did fulfill the word of the Lord. I went on the mission that the Lord sent me on. I captured Agag, the king of Amalek, and I destroyed Amalek. And the people took sheep and cattle from the spoils, the very best of the devoted property, to sacrifice to the Lord your God at Gilgal. And Samuel said, has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than to sacrifice, or to hearken than the fat of rams. For rebellion is like the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is like idolatry and teraphim. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king. And Saul said to Samuel, I have sinned. I have transgressed the commandment of the Lord, and your words as well. For I feared the people and obeyed their voice. Doesn't that sound familiar? Rings a lot like Aaron, right? I feared the people and obeyed their voice. Now therefore, I pray you, pardon my sin and turn again with me, and I will bow down to the Lord. And Samuel said to Saul, I will not return with you, for you have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel. And as Samuel turned to leave, he laid hold on the corner of his robe, and it tore. And Samuel said to him, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you this day, and has given it to a neighbor of yours who is better than you. Who's that?
David.
And also the Eternal One of Israel will not lie or change his mind, for he is not a man that he should change his mind. That is very long and bizarre. We never hear, when someone sins and gets punished, we don't hear this long back and forth, but I did, but I didn't. Okay, that's bizarre thing number one. Bizarre thing number two is this whole bit at the end about the Lord, the Eternal One of Israel will not lie or change his mind because he's not a man who lies and changes his mind. If the whole point of this, if the whole point here was that Saul didn't fulfill the commandments, if that was the whole problem, was they didn't obey, then we don't need that. We don't need, there's something weird here. There's something else going on. Okay, and to know what else is going on, you have to look at a very, very parallel story. Okay, King David also sins. King David also is confronted head-on by his prophet Nathan. What's the sin?
Bathsheba.
Right, Bathsheba. Right, he's something that, on the face of it, looks a lot worse than what Saul did. Right, he falls in love with Bathsheba, happens to be married. He says, okay, she's married, so we will arrange for the untimely battlefield death of her husband, Uriah the Hittite, and then she won't be married. A certain day comes along, and he gets a visit from Nathan the prophet. And Nathan is not very happy. He says to him, tells the story of the Kivsat HaRash, the poor man with the sheep. You know, the story, bottom line is, he confronts him. He confronts him the way that Samuel confronted him. And David says, I have sinned. Immediately. Confesses. And Nathan's words says, you know, you don't really deserve to be king. But you will get a stay. Okay? I'm not going to take the kingdom away from you. However, there will be turmoil in your house. Okay? It's not going to be fun for the rest of your life. And in fact, he has to fight a war against Absalom, his son. And in the time of Solomon, already things start to fall apart, and we get the basis of the complete dissolution of the unified monarchy. Okay, what's the difference between these stories, and what does it have to do with Judah and Tamar?
He behaves the same way, obviously. He immediately acknowledges the truth.
Right, as opposed to Saul. Saul, who goes back and forth saying, I envy him and he ubri up. I did, I didn't, but I did what God said, because, you know, sort of. So they didn't want to sacrifice to God. Right? And Samuel comes back and says, look, God isn't like this. Hemming and hawing and hibbity. He doesn't change his mind back and forth like a man. Okay, you're not being godlike when you play this game. You're a king. You're acting like a child. Right? You may see yourself as a child, but in God's eyes, you're the king of this whole people. Okay, so suddenly we see this idea of integrity. This idea of being as expressed in the ability to admit fault, to say the thing that is the worst possible thing you can admit to, simply because you have a duty to represent yourself truthfully in this world. Okay? That's what it's about. And in order to be the redeemer, right? The ultimate, what's a king? Okay, the king is the redeemer of Israel. It's the person who's capable of doing the most to make the world better. And to have that right in this people, you have to have an absolute commitment to your own integrity. Okay? So, all of a sudden, we go back and we see that oaths represent creating a place in this world where honesty is possible. Okay? But as soon as you say it's possible, that resonates out. It resonates out into many, many different areas in life. It forces us into every single place when we choose our career paths, when we choose the kind of people we hang around, when we choose the kind of words we say, at every point it forces us to say, wait a minute, maybe this is a moment in which integrity is perfectly reasonable and doable and possible and therefore mandatory. Okay, it radiates out from that little holy place and spreads out beyond and causes us to question and say, wait a second, maybe not only do I not have to sell timeshare condominiums, maybe salesmanship doesn't have to include that at all. Maybe we can live in a world in which my job is to sell something, and I can say, you know, I once had a real estate agent. I never forget this. My first real estate agent that I had helping me find an apartment in Jerusalem, one of the things that struck me about him was his clear willingness to say, you know, this apartment, I'm really sorry, this is just not for you. Okay, here are the good things about it, but here are the bad things about it. And I was amazed, because I'd never met any salesperson of any kind who would openly admit to the faults in the product he was trying to sell. But maybe he just figured me out. Or maybe this was just his style. He figured out that people would stick with him and be loyal to him more if he was open and honest about the pluses and minuses of any given piece of property. And that's exactly what happened. We ended up renting, or buying rather, through him, and he made a nice little profit on it because he was open and honest about it. Now, I don't know, maybe it's just wishful thinking. I have a belief that at least in this country, one of the things that distinguishes Israel, perhaps from other countries, in the United States in particular, is that I don't believe an Israeli politician can get away with saying what Schwarzenegger says in that interview. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's a little bit hopeful. But I certainly do believe, and I think that's the aim of the third commandment, that it's possible to live in a world in which integrity is always a presumed goal.
A what?
A presumed goal, a presumed ideal, presumptively possible. Okay? And if that's the case, then we've created yet another step in our step-by-step, let's see if I have, in our step-by-step creation of the redemptive society. Redemption, morality, integrity. Here's where we're holding. Next week we're going to spend quite a bit of time talking about the fourth commandment, the Sabbath.